And he finally spills the beans to Starling and explains, hey, I can navigate. And Starling's like, oh, yeah, a lot of us can hear the Nell. And he goes, no, I know where all the islands around here are. I can feel them. And Starling, that's the moment where Starling realizes, oh, that's a powerful ability that nobody out there has.
This bothered me a little bit that nobody else can do this, because I felt it was at odds with the theme of this book, that the old ways have merit. Just because you have all this technology doesn't make my traditions and my history any less. But then Starling just gives, and the rest of the Cosmere gives, more value to Dromanad based on this technology that they have. That felt a little at odds with what I was trying to be told, I think.
Welcome back to Following Noadon, a Stormlight podcast. We are finishing Isles of the Emberdark by Brandon Sanderson. I'm Elliot. I'm here with Paul and Trevor. As always, we are going to talk about the final chapters of Brandon's latest, most recently published book, at least at the time of recording this. Paul, Trevor, how are you guys feeling here at the end of our journey through the Emberdark?
The end of a not marathon, a marathon of a podcast, but not a marathon of a book. Feeling great about it. I've absolutely loved this book. I think it's been really charming and fun. Wrapping it up with a good little heaping tablespoon of Sanderlanch and ready to wrap it up. So, yeah.
Elliot, you mentioned last week how fast we finished this book.
Yeah.
Last week, and I kind of laughed to myself while Paul responded. But I meant to say last week that, yes, it only took us 3 months to do this book. Instead of, I'm sure somebody listening to that episode was like, you know, I read this in 3 days, and I've binged all 12 of your episodes or whatever we're on in a day. But, you know, for us, that's a lot. Give us a break, people. Yes, we have finished Isles of the Emberdark. I would like to go on record and say we only found one other isle in the Emberdark. Just saying. We have the potential to find other isles in the Emberdark now, but in the book we only actually found one. Yeah, good.
I do want to say, we should jump right into this actually, maybe to start with. As you were starting to spin these crazy theories, Trevor, about other perpendicularities and getting to other planets in the Dromanad system, I kept listening to you going, I wonder if that would have made a better story. Not to say the story was terrible. I actually really love the story. I'm going to talk about that in our wrap up. But you kept going on, and I was like, ooh, that's genius, and we're not going to go anywhere in that direction.
Let's start by saying that was not a complaint that we haven't seen a bunch of isles and peoples around Dromanad and First of the Sun. That's not a complaint. I'm just saying the title doesn't quite fit the book. It sounds good, but it doesn't quite fit the book. And maybe that's intentional to throw you off on we're only going to one other non-perpendicularity island, but it certainly successfully did that.
This is not the grand world tour of all the islands of the Emberdark. That's for sure. But it is a super fun adventure story, which actually I'm going to sing the praises of when we get to our wrap-up episode. But we are not there yet. We first need to dissect the final 8 chapters here, including the epilogue. Trevor, your mind blown by my counting
skills. Yeah, my 5-year-old could maybe teach you how to count. Yeah,
I learned from my 4-year-old, so yeah.
I will do my best to summarize this. We talked about it briefly in last episode, but Chrysalis is found, and shoveled into a pile and then put in an oven. And she narrowly escapes that after we turn around to go help her. And Dusk outmaneuvers the Dequara and says, "You work for me now." And the Dequara says, "Okay." And then the Dequara goes and eats all the Malwish, or half the Malwish, and spares the rest of them. And then we jump back to Vathi, and Vathi's like, "Man, I'm going to lose this election, and it's terrible. And if only Dusk could come back to save the day." And then Dusk comes back to save the day. And that's the book.
There you have it.
All right. Well, thank you all for this. Was a good week.
We'll do the wrap up next week.
Yep. There we go.
What more is there to say? What more is there to say? We should probably get into a few things. Yeah, maybe more than a few things in these chapters, because, like you said, this is our Sanderlanch for the book. It starts in chapter 56, where they fire the intensifier. Is this the one where they fire the intensifier at the Dequara? And nothing happens.
They fire it while it's attacking and nothing happens. That was, I believe, the end of last episode. And then they fire it at Starling, the beginning of this episode.
They do get into that pretty quick. Yep.
So they fired at Starling, and she holds it together with her own power. I was a little conflicted on that piece of information. But
why?
It just seemed a little ambiguous of, I'm using my powers that I'm not allowed to use to keep this manacle together that's preventing me from using my power, and I'm using my power to prevent it from using my power.
I think I didn't bat an eye at it, because I think it's been told to us that dragons have a certain, like, link to the spiritual realm or something like that. But
hasn't it been told to us that that's blocking her? Like, that her manacles are blocking her, that link?
Yes. They're blocking. I can see how you have trouble with this. I guess I was thinking of it as, it's blocking her ability to do anything with that. But
sure,
simply having a raw, direct tap into the infinite investiture that the spiritual realm is, gives her, like, this just kind of conduit of, she can kind of pour her own investiture tap into the manacles, kind of reverse the process a little bit. But I don't know, maybe you're onto something, that there's a oddity happening there.
This is not to, like, spin any theories about the manacles aren't actually doing their job or anything. I was a little tripped up on the whole point of these manacles, is she can't use her powers, and now she's using her powers to keep the manacles together. Yeah.
Maybe.
Anyway, she keeps the manacles together, voids the contract, and then the escape plan works, because the intensifier, like, pulls all the power out from all of the buildings and stuff like that. And they take off, and then they remember, oh yeah, we forgot Chrysalis. And then Zietzi says, "We have to go back. We have to go back, Kaladin," or whatever the line is from Syl.
Let's go straight to that line, since you're going there. Did that land for you guys, or did it feel too cheesy and predictable that we were going to go back for the one that nobody likes because that's what we have to do?
To me, it felt a little, I don't know, a little expected. I don't know. I feel like our group has been quite in their own quirky way, like, cheery protagonists. And it would have felt odd to me if they leave and then don't do something like this, and if they just kind of forget about it. I don't know. Especially, obviously, Starling is the leader, right? Like, she's, like, the cheeriest one of them all. I mean, Trevor and I were surprised by the artwork of her, because she seems so, childlike in a fun, happy way, you know? And yeah, it didn't, it felt, it feels a little cheesy, but frankly, it didn't feel too cheesy to me. It felt expected. Like I could really anticipate that this was going to happen here.
All I'll say is Zietze needs to look out for an honor sprint in his near future. if he was on Roshar, he'd have a little friend showing up pretty quick here. And maybe that's a bad thing because he doesn't like his Rosharians on the crew. But I didn't have a big issue with it. It did land fine. It's not like I was expecting a lot from this Sanderlanch. So, you know, going back to Save Chrysalis, the only like actual surprise is I thought Chrysalis was dead. I thought we actually were going to lose Chrysalis. So going back to save her, even if it was unsuccessful, was fine. I didn't have an issue with that, and it did land for me. It's fine.
I think for me it worked, but only just because I spent a good first at least 75% of this book, a lot like you guys, a little bit surprised that the scope of this book stayed as small as it did. Yeah. That I was waiting for the other shoe to drop, for the aperture to really open, and for us to go, you know, Cosmere wide, governments, planets, all this kind of stuff. I thought that's where we were going. And so this whole story, I was just kind of like, okay, but then we're going to get a big surprise. Okay, no, but then we're going to get a big surprise. Like just before these final chapters, it finally clicked with me. No, this is actually just a first person point of view, not literally, but kind of you're just in the head of one character or two characters the whole time. It's very straightforward. You have a very run of mill puts a negative spin on it. I don't intend, but a very kind of obvious hero who doesn't have any major flaws. You have a very like over the top villain who's very obviously a villain and not about to, you know, repent or take any curving, you know, character paths, whatever. This is just a very, in a lot of ways, traditional story format. And I wasn't expecting that. But by the time I got to this point, I think I had realized that. And so it was like, oh yeah, obviously we're going back to save the one that nobody trusts, because that's of course how the fairy tale ends, kind of thing. But it took me a long time to realize that was what this story was.
One thing I really agree with that you're saying, Elliot, and want to point out again, is the scope of this book did have big implications for the Cosmere and for the future of the Cosmere going forward. But this was not the book where we're bringing in the whole Cosmere cast to have a bunch of crossover and things like that. It mostly stayed in its own lane, in its own story, and I really, really enjoyed that. I think maybe it's a different perspective coming from Stormlight and the other like newer publications, that and then like Mistborn Era 2, where so much more is happening on the Cosmere scale, so much more like crossover and connections and dynamics of people and things like that. This one felt like a step back, and it felt, I personally think it was a bit of a welcome step back. Yeah, it was just nice. I don't know what else to say about it. But yeah, I was a bit surprised. I was fully, fully expecting us to go further into this cosmic. Like I said, I even said at one point, they're going to go through a perpendicularity and end up on just some other planet. Like some totally new planet, or maybe in the middle of some other story entirely that we already know. But that, you know, I think that kind of surprised me with this book.
I wouldn't say I was as surprised as you guys. I was expecting a self-contained story. But those wider Cosmere things that you guys are talking about are absolutely happening, just not in this book. Like, that there's obvious references to, there are big, to steal a term from Paul, movers and shakers in the Cosmere going on. It's just, we're not talking about that right now. That, like,
I survived the battle of such and such. And
right.
So, oh.
If you sat Starling down for 20 minutes, she could tell you all about what's going on in the Cosmere. It's just not, that's not what we're doing here.
What else happens in some of these chapters here? So we fire up the intense fire. It don't do much up against the Daquara. We end up going into the cave. We find out the cave is a dead end. They do make it to the cave. Bottom of the cave.
That bugged me for a little bit that the cave wasn't a cave, but the cave is a cave.
As opposed to a tunnel?
Tunnel. Yeah, it's not the tunnel of death. It's the cave of death. Wow. So absolutely, there should be a dead end. And it was correctly named. Okay, the reason why this bothered me so much, and I don't know if I ever mentioned it, but if you're going to name something on the cognitive realm, something that it's not, that's going to do things to it. If you're going to name it the cave of death, and it's not a cave, it might turn into a cave. If you name it the cave of death, it might have once been a tunnel. But if you name it the cave of death, now it's a cave. I thought that was funny that everybody was expecting this to be a tunnel titled the cave of death, and it was in fact a cave.
Have you not learned yet how the cognitive realm works?
Right. If we'd called it the tunnel of death, maybe it would have led to where Danger wanted it to, but it didn't. I was a little miffed on one, the military police lady from the last episode. She doesn't make another appearance as far as I saw. Maybe she died at the end of the at the end of the chapters here. But I was a little miffed on the sign from two episodes ago. The sign shows up and it's in his handwriting or whatever, and the cave of death is specifically designed around Dusk. Did that go anywhere? Did we get resolution to the cave of death? That felt like a loose end to me, but maybe it wasn't. I don't know.
It's a little hard to piece together, like thinking back on it, because you do get the feeling of, was this just a massive distraction throughout the whole thing? But I think where Dusk gets to it is, it's still a test of like worthiness, I guess.
Yeah.
Of
like, it, but is it? I was just fully on the sailboat of somebody is testing us,
right?
And then I felt that nobody was testing us, and it was just the Daquara. But maybe that was
Patchy. It's supposed to be autonomy.
Okay.
Has set up the thing, and Dusk is supposed to realize, I've been prepared for this.
Right.
This is a challenge that only I could do, and I'm ready for this. And that is where he realizes that he can take on the Daquara, because he is the hero and he's been prepared for this.
Maybe I just needed that scene spelled out to me. Maybe I just missed it, but I felt like autonomy should have showed up and said, this is a test. You're ready. Go put a leash on the Daquara. But I don't know. Maybe that I don't need that.
Well, I think we're supposed to be left with a little bit of a doubt of, is Dusk just imagining this connection he thinks he has with Patchy? Because multiple times he's like, oh, I've heard a voice. I know this is a thing. And I kind of leave the whole story going, again, thinking about shards and the big level of thing. Is this really like autonomy talking to Dusk? Or is this some fragment of autonomy flavored investiture that is just kind of an echo of where autonomy used to be? Kind of thing. Is Dusk really talking to an avatar or a shard or whatever, or is he just kind of maybe hearing what he wants to hear?
I guess I gave it more credit than you are, but yeah, I could see that.
But we do figure out the cave is a dead end. In that segment where they go into the cave the final time, Dusk does finally play his cards. He's spent this whole book with his cards as close to his vest as he can, very wisely so. And he finally spills the beans to Starling and explains, hey, I can navigate. And Starling's like, oh, yeah, a lot of us can hear the Nell. And he goes, no, I know where all the islands around here are. I can feel them. And Starling, that's the moment where Starling realizes, oh, that's a powerful ability that nobody out there has.
This bothered me a little bit that nobody else can do this, because I felt it was at odds with the theme of this book, that the old ways have merit. Just because you have all this technology doesn't make my traditions and my history any less. But then Starling just gives, and the rest of the Cosmere gives more value to Dromanad based on this technology that they have. That felt a little at odds with what I was trying to be told, I think.
I think that's interesting, Trevor. I didn't think of that, but I think you're right. I do remember hearing this. So the conclusion was Dusk can sense and navigate in the Emberdark, and so could people from Patchy, right?
Yes. If you if you're told you can and you train at it, that this is what we get the epilogue. He trains some of the trappers, and then some of them can and some of them can't.
Yeah. It was interesting to me. I assume it's an invested thing, because they make a comment at some point that Dusk is indeed invested. So I'm assuming it has to be tied to that. I guess it didn't, you know, that they have to train at it. I've been minorly confused by this. Minorly might be understating. Like, it makes sense, but it also doesn't make perfect sense to me about how this...
Like the power itself?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Like how some people can get it and some people can't, like even going through the same process, you know? I know they said it's kind of dependent on the person, but Dusk was, I feel like, kind of clearly like, yeah, if you come spend time on Patchy, and I think it kind of boils down to like your commitment to Patchy or something is what he talks about, like at least how Dusk himself communicates with Patchy, right? I don't know, it felt a little blurry to me.
I think it is a little blurry. Oh, here it is. I think I might have opened to it. I think there's a section in the epilogue where Ed the Arcanist is explaining a little bit and saying that the proximity to the perpendicularity, and he doesn't use the word connection, but I kind of imply it, of you have to have a connection to Patchy in order to get this ability. And so if you don't have some kind of capital C connection, it doesn't matter how invested you are, you still aren't getting this specific wayfinding ability.
But Dusk explains even those trappers who were close to Patchy, some of them didn't get it. So, and I don't have a big issue with that, because some of our magic systems, like on Elantris, if you know it, you know it. If you don't, you don't. But if there's some of them, like, you know, on Roshar, that you just got to have that Riz for the spren. Or else you just don't get it.
What else we got going on here? Then we get to the scene that, Trevor, you already kind of talked about a little bit, where we fire up the intense fire. We focus it on the manacles that Starling is wearing, and she has to pour her own power into them to hold them together, making her final decision that she is going to... Actually, there was a line in there I really liked that I didn't write down, but it was... And it's like, with that action, she held closed the door of her own prison with her own hands, or something like that.
Yeah.
And I thought that was actually kind of cool. Of she is making the choice to remain in the prison when she could get out for the sake of protecting her crew. Very admirable.
I thought it set up the epilogue really well, though. the end of this book, we close with, we're going to go find out how to free Starling. That's the, that's the goal of the crew, is we know it's possible now. I don't know if she has explained that explicitly to her crew, but we know it's possible to use one of these cool intensifiers. So now we're going to go Ocean's 11 on the southern continent of Scadrial and steal an intensifier to free Starling, which I don't know if we'll ever get to see that story, but that is cool.
I thought that was fun. And then I got a little bit hung up on, are the all-powerful dragons who put her in these manacles just going to be okay with that? Like, she's serving a sentence. Did, if she can figure out how to get out of the sentence, does she just get free? Or I feel like these dragons are so powerful, they'd just be like, oh, yeah, did you hear Starling wrecked her manacles the other day? Ah, yeah, send Bob and go put another pair on her.
Yeah, she explained it briefly back when the intensifier was introduced, that she could, if she accepts Danger's contract, is what she says, then she, and if it works, she would successfully get her manacles off, but the contract with the dragons would still be intact, and she wouldn't be allowed to, she still wouldn't be allowed to go back to Yolen or whatever.
Right.
So, I don't know. I think it would work. It's just the letter of the contract would still be intact.
Yeah. But yes, I do feel like that was an intentional loose end left there of, next time we see Starling, maybe as a cameo some other where, we better pay close attention where whether she has manacles on or not.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I like what you're saying, Elliot, because I'm like, do the dragons have to then go and look at the technology that they're doing here and figure out how to, you know, protect and make their manacles unbreakable? Or are they just like okay with this? Or do they try to enforce it? Is she going to get a longer, like, you know, sentence? That's kind of funny. They're kind of, it is kind of the situation where it's like, oh yeah, you know, we gave you these manacles, but like, we're not going to enforce them, you know, like if you get out of them, then woohoo, you just, it's like if you broke out of jail, then they were like, yep, you earned your freedom, you know, like,
yeah,
it's kind of funny.
Although now that I quibble about that, isn't that like maybe part of the thing in Tress when they meet Zysus, is he's like, well, you know, I'll give you a chance to talk yourself out of it. Go ahead. You know, maybe dragons like that. If you've got the gumption to figure out a way to worm out of your sentence, then good on you. Congratulations. You've earned it.
In the dragon's defense, it's never happened before. So they haven't had to worry about one of their dragonettes releasing early or whatever.
Which the dragons, I think, maybe would do well to listen to, I think, what Chrysalis was talking about a few times in this book, of technology is catching up to the gods.
Yeah.
And Chrysalis seems to understand this full well, of, I used to be a god, nobody could touch me, and now there's all this technology that really kind of shrinks my power on the large scale. I feel like maybe the dragons haven't looked at it that way yet. Maybe it's going to sneak up on the dragons a little bit. Of,
are the dragons too proud to admit this?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What'd you guys think of the dusk final scene of him spearing a snake and swerving this way and spearing a snake and swerving that way to zigzag his way to the middle island? I was fully expecting to see at least the remnants of another perpendicularity. One that maybe Kakaban closed at the time or something. I wasn't disappointed by the bones of Kakaban. I thought that was pretty cool. But I thought the scene of getting past the Dakora was quite good. I would applaud Brandon on his epic visuals here. I thought it was good.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty satisfying. You really like, this was one of those that I think benefited from us, you know, reading through this pretty quick. It felt like as we were getting to this moment, this was just a really satisfying, cool imagery it's one of those scenes as you wrap up a book that's just like easy to go along with. I think you could zoom out and look at this and be like, you know, Dusk is a great trapper, but like that was a bit much for him even, I feel like. But like it's so fun to get lost in that like epicness of that like scene. I thought it was awesome. That was really cool. I absolutely loved it.
Does he take full control of the Daquara, or does he just say, you now listen to me? Like, what I'm trying to get at here is, does Dusk attack the Malwish, or does the Daquara attack the Malwish at the end of the book?
I see what you're asking. In my reading of the book, I think I would say Dusk. I think he's got full control of that thing by the end. It serves him. It doesn't do squat that he doesn't tell it to do. So I think when I chuckle when I read your note in the outline here, big snake eats big ship.
That's what happened.
Yep. I fully attribute that to that's Dusk sending the Daquara to chomp on the big giant gunship. And I think there's a few nuggets Brandon throws in there to make sure that Dusk is not totally bloodthirsty. I don't know if you remember, after the snake chomps the ship in half, like half of it explodes and half the crew dies, but then the other half like starts to fall off the island and sink into oblivion, and the snake actually goes and retrieves it and saves like half the crew and brings it back and intentionally doesn't kill. Like, I kind of attribute that to, you know, that's making sure that all of a sudden Dusk isn't a big killer of hundreds of people. He's saving a few. He's doing what he can.
No. This is a joke to preface. You're giving too much credit to Dusk. He's leaving survivors to tell the epic tale of his of his Daquara.
There you go.
Dead men tell no tales. He has to leave some survivors. Now, I did notice the Daquara saving the rest of the ship, which I thought was kind of funny, that all the officers and all of the higher ups that are complicit with danger are going to be right up front there, and then all the crew who are arguably more innocent presumably are saved. I thought that was a little cheeky and funny.
There is a line in chapter 61 that I thought was the most Brandon quote ever. And it has to do with, like, how do you beat a god? I just have to read it for you guys. "Gods," Ed said, "could not be contained by steel, ceramic, or even an invested shield. But a story, well, that was another thing entirely." I had to pause when I read that for the first time and went, ah, yes, there it is. We've got a story with heroes and gods and technology and cool links between all of those. But what's the most powerful thing of all? The story.
All right. Earlier in the book, I claimed that the quote of muscles were the best tool ever, or whatever, I butchered that quote. But I claimed that quote was going to be the best quote from the book. Now I have to look it up on Goodreads to see which one is the most upvoted. Somebody say something while I look this up.
The thing I just read is not like the most quotable. It's a little bit embedded in the rest of a paragraph, but I could tell that was Brandon's takeaway from all this, is even the most powerful guys can be constrained by the story you tell about them.
Unfortunately, I have to throw out this theory of the best quote from Emberdark based on Goodreads, because the most voted quote has 4 likes. The sample size of the pool is not quite high, but the top voted quote from the book is, "Stories are important," he said. "I live because of the stories of trappers who told me what to avoid." That's the most upvoted quote.
Hmm. Everybody get out there over to Goodreads and start voting on quotes for this one, because I feel like we could do better than that.
Yes, agreed.
Ooh, question for you guys. Have you picked up your physical copy since finishing the book?
I have not.
Ah.
I have not either. And I have made a point to, because of some cool art that's described. And yeah.
I have a not artwork related reveal for you. We had a big old reveal that I worked you guys up to early on at the end of book one, where the pages turned to black. They turned back to white just for the epilogue. So when you get to the epilogue and you turn that page, it's back to the kind of normal format of a book with white pages and black ink. I briefly toyed with the idea of telling you guys you had to read that in person and in the physical copy, but it's not nearly quite the emotional impact of the other one. But
whoa, it turns to white pages.
But yeah, take a look at your book and you'll see the very last section of the book goes back to white after being black for 350 pages.
Did you notice this at the end of the book?
I did notice that. That matches the ornament you got, right?
Yeah. So yeah,
the Triforce.
It's the little snake defending the Deathly Hallows or whatever. And I got the ornament from Dragonsteel, and it's that same. Is that the medallion from?
Yeah, Teflon, I think that's supposed to be the symbol from the medallion.
That's pretty cool. This is more of a quick note on what we'd read. Some of the things that come up here. I don't know how long we need to talk about it, but so we had the prediction on whether or not Hoid will show up, but. I also said that I think Vothi was going to make another appearance, even if brief, and I was right about that. So I feel pretty good about my end of book predictions, honestly. Hoid was the easier one, but we did get some Vothi content, and it was... I feel like I was kind of spot on. It was basically like, yep, Vothi's working on political things. She does end up being, I guess, a little more involved because we kind of like come back. It's kind of funny moments, you know, there. But anyways, that was my earlier, Trevor, you said someone say something while I look this up. And I didn't actually have time to squeeze it in, so I'm saying it now. But I was like, Vothi, we did see Vothi. So check for my little, I just count the wins that I can get, you know.
Not only did we see her, we got a point of view from Vothi, yes, which I think was more accurate to your prediction.
Yeah.
The nugget of Dusk joining Starling's crew at the end of the book as navigator, I thought was really cool, where Dusk has acknowledged that his role on First of the Sun and Patchy has been fulfilled, and he'd like to go explore the Cosmere. And here goes Starling about to take off. And then, you know, Dusk goes and joins the Millennium Falcon. So I thought that was pretty cool.
I actually did think that was super cool too. I could see that one maybe coming across for a few people as cheesy and very predictable. I think it's very early on when we meet Starling. They spend a few pages talking about, oh man, I wish we had a navigator. Oh man, it'd be nice if we had a navigator. We could have done this if we had a navigator. Oh wait, look, here we go. We can plug this hole with Dusk. It, for me, it worked 100%. I thought that was a great, you know, very happy way to end the story of Dusk. Dusk needs an adventure. He's not a person who's going to ever be happy in retirement of, all right, give him a happy beach house and he's good to go. Like, he needs adventure. And Dusk and them could really use someone like him. It felt like a good fit.
I agree. I didn't know how the story would end for Dusk, but I think this was very fitting of he basically gets to go on an adventure. You know, he gets to go sail off and discover, especially because it's especially satisfying because so much of this book at the start is about how Dusk does not really fit in and does not, yeah, just does not fit in with the current life going on. So this was really cool. Like having a group, having a community, not just him being on his own. We even had theories of like, you could have this almost tragic ending for Dusk where he ends up shutting himself off to be a solo traveler in the, you know, in the Emberdark. And while there is a way that that could have been done really cool, this is definitely the happy ending, which is really nice to have Dusk and his little crew. I like it.
Well, I think Kakoban got the tragic ending that we were talking about, and
oh, yeah,
and Dusk didn't. So Kakoban sacrifices himself to defend, you know, his crew, or defends First of the Sun or whatever, and Dusk gets to live happily ever after because of what Kakoban did.
It definitely wants to make me hit next on my Netflix remote and go to season two. I want to know what the adventures of Captain yeah. Starling and crew are going to be.
Do you think we'll ever get it?
Maybe. I don't know.
Like,
I hope we do. I hope we do.
This one, more than any of the other secret projects, I feel more confident in, not necessarily Isles of Emberdark 2, but a story about Starling and Dusk. I felt that was more applicable here as opposed to any of our other secret projects.
I think Starling 100% shows up again somewhere. At least Starling right. does. Whereas like Tress, Yumi, not gonna bet very much on them popping up again. But Starling, I think Brandon is trying to build something there with Starling, and that he's gonna use that again.
Well, and even so, I would even say Sigzil has obviously high potential to show up in other things, but I think this book specifically has a more higher chance to get a direct sequel than Sunlit does. Like, I don't expect Sunlit 2. I'm expecting Sigzil to show up in other things, but right. I would expect this to get a, like, I wouldn't say I expect it. It's a higher chance for this to get a direct sequel, I think.
It's just a question of when does that work its way into Brandon's writing schedule?
Yes. Okay. We should talk about this real quick. So I think 2 years ago, Brandon in the State of the Sanderson gave us the calendar of, this is when you can expect Mistborn Era 3. This is when you can expect Stormlight Era 2. Like he gave us the next 10 years of what was on this calendar. Isles of the Emberdark nor Fires of December were on that calendar. So true. I feel like he's discrediting himself with this calendar.
I think there were other things, like I think things like Horn Eater were on the calendar and right. now have and Elantris like, completely 2. Fallen yeah. off.
Right. Elantris 2, the long form version of White Sand, those have been pushed, and then things like this just show up. So I think
it could happen.
Dismantling his own calendar in favor of what sounds interesting to him, which that's not a complaint. I'm just laughing at the detail.
All right. So our crew sails off into the sunset. Anything else you guys take away from these final chapters?
I was a little hesitant to say that it will all live happily ever after for First of the Sun. I still felt like poachers would show up at the door of this perpendicularity and try to exploit it. However, we have successfully established how well this entity can defend against modern technology. The last third of the book, or maybe even the last half of the book, was establishing how much of an issue this entity is for our modern day Cosmerines. So I maybe should give the entity a little bit more credit on being able to defend First of the Sun and getting them Cosmere current like we are now. But I originally was a little skeptical that First of the Sun might still try to be exploited by someone.
All righty. Well, we're going to spend quite a bit more time talking about the book as a whole and going through our ratings and themes and quotes and things like that in our wrap-up episode. But there's one question that I am just itching to ask you guys. So I'm going to pull the trigger now. I want one word. I want a one word answer, and we can go into it in far more detail next week. One word answer. Can you read Isles of the Emberdark first?
First
Cosmere book you ever read.
I think absolutely. I think yes.
Man, I want to say yes.
I absolutely think yes. It's actually, I mean, I've stopped to think for a second, but I definitely think yes.
I'll have to. I think I have to think about this. I don't think I can answer you this week.
We can talk about it more in depth later. I have many thoughts I'd love to share. I don't know if I'm allowed to.
We should save the detailed thoughts for next time, I think.
Okay. I would say right now, no. However, I am open to convincing, and we can talk about it more next week. That's what I'll say.
I asked this of some folks in our Discord a while ago. I asked it right after I read it for the first time. It's about 3 months ago. And the overwhelming response I got back was absolutely not. That this is a capstone Cosmere work. And that there were multiple people saying you have to read everything else first until you open this. And I kind of felt alone in that I'm much more, I think, aligned with Paul over there of, I'm inclined to say you don't. Maybe you don't even need to read any of it.
Yeah. I think there are some things you will definitely be lost on. Like what makes our crew members special. But I think you certainly could. And you could chalk a lot of that up to Magic Universe. And then discover it later on. I absolutely think that's the case.
I have more thoughts on it too. I think we should have a much bigger discussion next week when we look back our retrospective on the book as a whole. But any final thoughts, guys, on these last set of chapters for the book?
It was a pleasure to read this, and it certainly was a nice after meal mint from Wind and Truth. And I really enjoyed, I enjoyed how confined it was, even more so than Sunlit. So Sunlit, I wanted it to push, and I wanted all the Cosmere ties and stuff like that. This one, I enjoyed them when they showed up, but I wasn't begging for them. So like, the Cosmere ties, which we'll talk about more next week on whether you can read this early or first or whatever. First, it's crazy. But I enjoyed the wider Cosmere ties when I received them, but I wasn't really hungry for them when I read Sunlit. That being said, I think it walks a great line of if you know, you know. And if you don't, that's fine. So I really enjoyed it for that aspect of this is Dusk's story. Even though he's in a big world, he's clearly in a big world. That's fine. This is still Dusk's story. So I really enjoyed it for that purpose.
Yeah. I agree. I was also not thirsty for more Cosmere crossover. I feel like we've gotten a lot, and that's fun, but I'm okay investing heavily in this, where hypothetically, if we see Dusk down the road or something, like, like that'd be cool. Like having more characters that have really been invested in, instead of like, you know, as we get to the end of this book, some like superstar rock Cosmere roster rolls in and helps the hero. You know what I mean? So, yeah, I agree. I think it towed a good line. I am with Elliot, though. I will go out on the limb to say, yes, you could read this first.
we'll stage a debate later, later on. So start gathering your evidence and your points for that. I'll say too, just to wrap up, I enjoyed this book a lot, especially as Trevor, you coined it extremely well. I like this a lot. The after dinner mint after the giant meal that is Stormlight. It is a great little bite-sized, it's a little funny to be talking about a book that's still pretty hefty, but at least for Brandon's, you know, Brandon's scale, bite-sized story that you don't have to think too hard about. It's going to make you think. It's still got some meaty themes into it and some bigger impacting things, but you don't have to really buckle down and dissect every little thing. You can just kind of go along for the ride with Dusk as he's exposed to so much new stuff, and you're just kind of along for the ride. And it was a very different story than I feel like we've read, even of the other secret projects. I feel like all of those I had to go in with my thinking cap on. Maybe that's just me and other people are having more fun reading them. But even like Tress, there's enough going on there that you're like, you know, trying to figure out what the heck is this and what the heck is this. This one, I never really kind of got stuck on what the heck is this. I just was there for the ride, and I think I enjoyed it a lot because of that.
Let me rebuttal that real quick. I think that's because of the order that you got them. I think if you got Tress now, you'd enjoy it for its bite-sized nature, if you got Isles of the Emberdark as your first secret project, mm-hmm. you would be way more inclined to have your thinking cap on. But because of the order that you receive them, I think that Tress, you're way more likely to be, you know, how does this tie to Scadrial? How does this tie to Roshar? But now that we're on where we are, you're less inclined to do that.
You may be onto something there, and maybe that's even a point in the favor of read this later. Not that you need to read it later. Maybe just that the experience of this book is better later and that you aren't asking the questions. It's not that you need to know the answers going into it. You can do it the other way. But your experience of this book is going to be very different if you're reading it trying to find the answers versus already knowing the answers and just kind of coming at it from a place of knowledge.
Thanks. I'll use that next week.
Yeah. I just gave you a lot of ammo there, didn't I? All righty. Anything else, gentlemen?
If you have arguments to support my position for next week, please let me know, and I will I will come prepared next week.
Joke's on him. We're going to record our next episode before this one goes live. Ha
ha. Ha ha.
Yeah, well. All right, that's all I had.
And with that, we better wrap this up. Thanks for joining me, folks. We are done with Isles of Emberdark. I'm excited to talk about it as a book as a whole with you guys next week. I'll see you then.
Toodles.
I enjoyed the snake steak.